I'm Rachel Allen.
And I'm Jack Underwood.
And welcome to the Faber Poetry Podcast.
Hello, my name is Eve Esfandiari-Denny, and I'm currently in my friend's bedroom, feeling slightly self-conscious. They think I'm mumbling to myself while they make dinner. But I'm going to read a poem anyway. This one is from a short collection I've been working on called Girling. And most of these poems speak to the subject of white passing. But maybe this poem, I guess, yeah, this poem does too. But it's more specifically about my dad, who is a Romani traveller who was adopted by the Salvation Army when he was little. Joseph in boy mask and can fly. After Ode to the 20th Century by Laksa Manas, a Latvian Romani poet who wrote, "Our steps might seem light as birds, but in reality." Joseph is not bird, is smooth down hair and left in a holy army alcove. His no crying and mouth shut straight like an envelope, enclosing a still song. He is staying still where the found things come to wait. Waiting is Joseph, seated among a mahogany line of plain chairs belonging to the Salvation Army Citadel. Joseph, still dark wings folded under a jumper, waiting. Waiting is still not moving image of a bird. Joseph is not bird, is an unfamiliar lap of hands, his hands of small, small body, sitting, not flying, as he looks up to sing, "My name is Joseph." Joseph, so unpersoned, so his noun is trying to be known as the sound of canoe plant or moo cow through a megaphone of English between symbols. Joseph trying to be known as the sound of bird in a shell, no longer self-shushing but departing bird sound through thin air. Joseph is traveller, is not bird, but turns left by pilot organs. Can disturb an ecosystem even below a holy ceiling, holy enough to confine God to the indoors, to a room so sure as 100 congregated and hearing hands. Can you assign him to a different melody of language? Said the thin air, said the God maybe. Joseph is not bird, but has a nowhere Romani mother, is anatomically nomadic like other holy bodies, but no, no, everything him has come from someone else. As if Joseph is not bird, is adoption paper sanctioned by a plate of stars and ham, a salvation parade, shining instruments. Here is another new father, a pair of white socks, Joseph. They do not hover above the floor. So Joseph is not bird, and believe he is turning into creed, into bones opened up in a line of flight. So saved by salvation, so Joseph must sing so loudly and so badly, to conceal a silence, getting lost in translation, the taste of knowingness, undisturbed, is a full stop. Joseph is not bird, is pure Joseph, pure lunged mammal. The God air will clean itself when crossing the threshold from voice to white song. It can defamiliarize, become emblem of flight, or dissolve all directions, like a home and home of bird.
And that was an audio postcard from Eve Esfandiari-Denny. Her debut pamphlet, My Bodies This Morning, This Evening, was published by Bad Betty Press in February 2022. And joining us in the studio today, we have Camille Ralphs. Camille is a poet, critic, and editor. Her poems and translations have appeared in the New York Review of Books, the Poetry Review, the Spectator, and London Magazine. She's the author of three pamphlets, one of which was shortlisted for the Michael Marks Award. She's also writes critically for publications, including The Telegraph, The Poetry Review, and The Los Angeles Review of Books as well. She's a regular contributor for Poetry London and also conducts an interview series for Poetry Birmingham Literary Journal. She's the poetry editor at the Times Literary Supplement, and her debut, After You Were, I Am, will be published by Faber in 2024. Welcome, Camille.
And joining Camille today is Stephanie Sakia. Stephanie Sakia's debut poetry collection, Amnion, was published by Granta in 2021 and won the Forward Prize for Best First Collection, the Somerset Maugham Award, and Eric Gregory Award, and was the Poetry Book Society's winter recommendation. It was also longlisted for the Rathbones Folio Prize and RSL Ondaatje Prize.
So reading for us first today, we'll have Stephanie. Stephanie, would you like to read something for us?
Yes. So I've got the kind of opening pages of the second section of Amnion in front of me now. So I'm going to read you some of them. Of Canterbury, I recall scuff, stone smell, shoe seep, smell at crotch of tights, blazer. To the school, I am delivered, a 3-hour drive north through a veiled land replete with cathedrals. There is Amiens with its traces of paint still, and Chartres of the windows, Beauvais, unfinished, 3 times its spire fell through. Now it is braced with wooden beams, on crutches. It boasts the highest clerestory in Europe. It smells of mouldering stone. Reims, where are buried the kings. Coulon, which boasts the foreskin of the Saviour. Under the channel, to burst forth near a hill where runs a horse, white in chalk. I remember that boat, smallest to answer the call, named Tamzine. It lies on the floor of the Museum for Imperial War, the littlest of the little ships of Dunkirk, clinker-built from Canadian spruce. The school is of flint and brick. It too has a cathedral. At the boarding house, which is new but built out of the ruins of the old infirmary 10 centuries old, another mother is wearing a poncho. She asks where we're from, how we got here. At my mother's reply, the Eurotunnel, she says, "Oh well, you will have come in under our land then." I am unpacked and stowed away. The land seemed so old, but deluded also. The white horse that leaps on the green hill, singing in chalk, is a copy. The stone of the cathedral came from Caen, where as a child in an oversized fleece, I stood in a very large crater near the Museum of Peace. My father was at D-Day and was shot in the hip. He lay on the beach in the surf for 3 days. My godfather has my baby sister strapped to his chest. This cool, cold plain of Europe's beige edge is on par with Mont-Saint-Michel, its great, flat-footed expanse where my brother and I dig its ridges for clams before the tide comes running. This is deep, bone-knowing country. Albion. I hold it in my mouth with pleasure, like a corpulent pearl. My femalehood was bordered over my eyes like a set piece. To determine its deviance became the all-consuming aim. Cover your shoulders. Shoulders remind boys of boobs. My body became as incendiary as a vernacular. It was the thing that lay in the dark woods at the trailing ends of sentences, at the short edge of night and late at skirt. The blonde others aspired to be described with mean, hard-nosed little words, thin, pretty, nice. I wanted big femur words like wise and kind. The boys were always touching each other. When the parents came, they were loud. They came 2 by 2 in pairs of Sunday lunching racists. The fathers wore trousers the colour of rare meat. A hunk of roast beef seeping, banking on things in the city, with flats useful for unfaithing. Their wives stayed at home in the counties. Maybe they were lonely and screamed themselves hoarse in the cutstone quiet of their houses. These marriages seemed structures of mutual scorn. Watching them made me flush hot with fear that this was coming for me and sent me knock-kneed to hide. Their days of barbered torpor, the cream-coloured afternoons.
Thank you so much, reading
one of my favourite parts of the book, but it's hard to choose a favourite because the entire of the thing is my favourite part of the book. Camille, would you like to read for us as well?
Sure. Just the one?
Yeah.
You can read two. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, we'll do two then. I'm going to read two from the first section of the Faber volume, which is a sequence of poems that began as rewritings of canonical prayers or religious reflections. This first one is after Jalal al-Din Rumi. What if the brain's pink impulses can only disappoint us? What if why, wearing that black backless address, is not a who? We are the ones who do the crimes, and yet you are the wanted one. The episodic soul is like a sitcom filmed in unreal time. To care about this sort of thing is as wise as a digital clock. But if the sky weren't trapped in days and nights revolving door, the undomesticable zodiac would use our every coffined litter as a tray. And arguably, London is more spit than shine for days, but does it not shine somewhere? Somewhere so clean we can see ourselves in everything. If you can, give voice to the throaty red anthurium, to the window, to the wall, that makes these rooms matter and these stanzas matter. Through change, a whipping post becomes postmodern art. Through change, a second advent turns to venture capital. The episodic soul is moving at a quickening remove from this unchecked, unbalanced world of checks and balances, dances a totem dance and sings ototototoy at billions of creatures clocking off into the void. Then comes to us our look, like a black cat in a dark room, purring ergonomically. Then sends it us, price guns like tasers at our hips, to value all the world, its messianic shabbiness. Both pearls and vinegars have mothers, it now seems. And the mother of invention is necessity. And boy, do we need you. And the second one is a take on the final bit of the Book of Job, where Job, who has been extensively tested by God by having his belongings, all of his livestock, his children, his wife, etc., taken away from him and his face afflicted with boils, is given back everything that was taken as a sort of reward for keeping his faith. And it begins with a quotation from Anna Kamienska's notebook, as translated by Claire Kavanagh. Yesterday, P asked, do you think the children from Job's second chance could actually be happy? But then, amid the helplessness of lives and corrugated sewage, underneath the heavens cold and hatchback tabernacle absolute in night and then in the tubercular dawn, the man who had been locked in place, shocked by his loss of face and family, was loosed, and then the world donated to him twice what had been gone. His children, whom he'd seen the fired pyres stripping of their nakedness and every woolly talisman, came back, came bringing groceries. And they said, this is what a bad trip feels like. We were never dead, you only thought we were. And though he had mislaid his face in hills of boils, had dropped his eyes in lozenge bottles, crouched behind the ziggurats of shipping boxes at the docks, screamed at life's fair unfairness, they beatified him, decorated him with reassurances that tugged like ugly gold hoops at his ears. So in the end, he was more blessed, which in some tongues translates as wounded, than in the beginning. But he cried, I said, I know you're as dead as the oxen, the asses, the camels, the sheep that the Mesopotamians carried away in that book. And he blessed the world in turn because he feared to curse it. Blessed the mad black flowers crackling hotly in the planet's gradients of heart, the bed mud of the Mersey, their grey gradual becoming. Blessed the names that passed like pills or golem spells under the drawbridge of his tongue and his roarings that poured like the waters. Blessed his eye, trapped now inside another cranky orbit, and the broken hug of him, ungrasping child and fatherless. And any liberal, and always liberally worded, words they said were only words. He still missed what they said had not gone missing. After this is after that, he said. And if this were a bad trip, I would know it. And did not escape the feeling, angry as a tennis racket, of his being made to serve. You're dead," he said, watching his children reproduce. And soon they too grew to believe it.
Thank you so much, Camille. I feel like I've got loads that I want to talk to both of you about concerning histories and wordplay and how we rewrite myth, how we write into myth, personal mythologies, communal mythologies, universal mythologies. But first, because you've mentioned a woolly talisman already.
I knew you were going to do that.
Naughty. Camille, do you want to talk to us about your talisman? Also, I should probably preface this by saying this is one episode where Jack's not in the studio with us today. He's on Zoom. So if it sounds a little different, that's the why.
Hi. am I different? Am I so different?
You're not so different. You're just the same.
But I will need you to show me the talisman. Yeah,
right. It's a bit heavy, so get ready for this. Okay. And I'm afraid you're going to have to get over the immense cringe factor as well, because I'm afraid I have brought with me 6 copies of the Faber Poetry Diary, starting in 2018, right through to this year, to the Faber Poetry Podcast. And it's not the Faber connection that's the reason these have come with me. It's something else. So I am a consummate over-preparer. I overprepare for everything. And when I was listening to the back catalogue of podcasts before coming in for this, I realised that in a previous episode, somebody had brought in a dictionary and talked a lot about etymology. So my first talisman idea, which would have been my concise Oxford Etymological Dictionary, has had to be left at home. And then I realised that was itself very telling, because I am constantly putting things in the diary and obsessing over them and timekeeping all the time. And I have a very particular way of writing, which is I find an idea or an idea finds me, and then the diary comes out, and over a month or a couple of months, I'm in there every day. Sort of like a training program almost. And there have been particular times when I've been very deliberate about that as well. Can I put these somewhere? They're quite heavy.
Yeah, put them here.
Yeah, yeah.
I was just about to say that I think that we couldn't be more opposite. I don't think I've prepared for a thing in my life. And I'm in awe of you. I'm in awe of just how, like, wonderfully representative, actually, those diaries are. How we can sort of, just keep track of things and make notes in that way. And to think that all of your life is in here is quite moving. Yeah,
so are they the actual filled diaries?
Yes.
They're not props to represent diaries elsewhere?
They're real diaries, Jack. Look, I mean, they're quite threatening, actually, because they're heavy now. And the pile is becoming really quite tall. And every year it gets bigger. And it feels like more of my life is being given to this diary, like it's a sort of vampiric presence on my on my shelf.
Nice. It's a really nice insight into your process, actually, and also will maybe link to some of the things I want to talk to you about in regards to sort of planning and mapping. I feel like in your collection, I see you map certain histories against ideas of the self and ideas of the contemporary, and that sort of planning insight feels very true to your book as I read it, actually. Dear Stephanie, what talismanic beast have you bought for us?
Well, I would love to say that I've brought you my lucky knickers. Although how I would that be in the form of wearing them, which maybe the
you
idea.
Could have.
How would we know? Would you suspect that you needed them really for the Faber podcast? I mean, it's a doddle, isn't it?
Well, so this is the terrible thing. I would love to say that I've brought them because they have served me well, but they got eaten by a dog a couple of years ago. Which is very cat ate my homework, but it's true. So,
hang on. You can't say so and then proceed.
There's really no story
there.
A
dog ate your knickers. How does that happen?
They weren't on me at the time.
Right,
thankfully.
Good. Okay.
What was worse was I was. It wasn't my dog. Somebody else's dog. And then when somebody, maybe this has happened with friends of yours and their children or their pets, where pet/child misbehaves, and then Maybe this is letting people into far too much.
I'm not sure about this second person that's creeping in here. This isn't about my lucky pants. This is about your. Okay, yeah, continue.
Basically, the dog ate the pants, and I was very upset because, as I say, they were my lucky pants, and they had served me very well. They'd had an illustrious career, I suppose. I'm going into far too much. bigging them up far too much. And the person whose dog it was sort of went, oh, sorry. And that was that.
It's like that Sex and the City episode.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And the lucky pants have not been replaced. I was thinking what my backup talisman would be. I suppose I have many talismans. At the moment, I'm wearing a lion pendant that my boyfriend gave me, actually. But his rationale when he gave it to me was because of my mane, I have incredibly thick hair, which has been a real battle to deal with all my life. But I'm also kind of fascinated by hair. Almost every culture in the world has some kind of restriction based on hair to do with maturity, and like the erotic potential of hair is quite interesting to me. Mane, hair, something I think about quite a lot, I would say.
That's cool. So you're really leaning into the, was it furry talisman?
Woolly
talisman.
Almost.
I love it.
Mm. Yeah, good. I mean, as a man without much hair these days, the erotic potential of hair. that hurt. But yeah, that's interesting. And you mentioned like you haven't replaced the lucky pants. I just keep going. I'm not to go back to the lucky pants. But where I'm interested in where in the market for a new pair, where would one go?
I'm not sure I have the answer to that.
How do they become lucky? You figure them out?
Well, maybe I think something lucky happened to me when I was wearing them, and then so they were lucky by self-decree, I think.
Lucky by association.
So you just got to wait. Yeah. Okay.
Well, this is nice. This was like a good wayward way in to both of your books, which I have in front of me on PDF, which is actually quite nice because I can sort of like move through them and draw these networks and connections and bridges between them, which I've been thinking about for a while anyway with both of your work, because I feel like one of the most, not obvious, but I think maybe sort of immediate connections I have between your books is this kind of idea of writing histories, rewriting histories, be those personal, private, or public. And both of your books have larger, overarching concepts, which I'm sure you'll speak a little bit more about. And I guess I just wanted to pose a kind of conversation opener to you both about this approach towards history and the intention behind a kind of rewriting of a history or a writing of a history. And what does that feel like for you personally, politically, culturally? Is there some kind of corrective perhaps that you're offering some kind of admiration? Or are you attempting to maybe sort of give your own slant or spin on histories that may feel like they warrant it from you? Camille, maybe you can.
Well, one part of the book, definitely the last thing that you said, histories that warrant more attention, the Malkin poems, that certainly applies to them, because in that case, the Pendle witches of the early 17th century Pendle witch trials, who, you know, 13 women and men, predominantly women, who were either hanged or punished in horrendous ways for the alleged crime of witchcraft. They haven't really been dealt with much in literature before, certainly not to the same extent as Salem witches in The Crucible, for instance. And when I came across that story a long time ago now, when I first heard it, I did think to myself, that's, you know, bloody tragic, and somebody should have something to say about that. The other stuff, I think I'm just someone who gets fixated on different personalities and very much enjoys dramatic monologues, very much a dramatic monologue person or a early modern drama fan, and find that the way of getting into poems that appeals to me. I find writing a normal lyric poem very difficult for some reason. I don't seem to have that moment of inspiration that some people talk about. It's more like the diary thing. You know, I come across an idea, a historical thing, a group of people, an interaction that catches my eye, or a way of looking at the world. And I think, well, now I can, you know, I can have a way into that and I can represent it in my language. And that's my way of being a part of it.
Mm. Do you think that, I think both of you as having quite distinct voices, and I'm interested in this, that how history works in relation to that. I mean, mentioning the sort of garden variety lyric poem. I think lyric poetry tends to be slightly more presentist, doesn't it? It sort of seems to be located within a contemporary moment, not just of the speaker speaking, but one that's evoked by the voice and the vernacular and that sort of thing. I wonder if having a sense of place or history or these other voices, what that does to sort of poetic voice and how it not forces but invites you to sort of corral a different range of references and into that. Yeah, that kind of manner of speaking.
And that comes formally as well, actually. Like thinking about Amnion, which I feel is like an epic narrative poem. And those sort of, that corralling of different voices comes through a form that historically invites that, right?
Well, I mean, I was going to say, I think the parallels between, like a really big parallel which strikes me between my work in Camille's is actually the religious focus and interest. And I think that religious poetry in the broadest possible sense, in that it is concerned with religion, perhaps not in the sense of being devotional poetry, but like that's not really seen as a particularly sexy, hot topic at the moment. But actually, I find it extremely irritating. Sorry, extremely interesting and invigorating, and can also be extremely sexy in all the possible senses of the word. And I think, you know, Camille's emphasis on kind of prayer and like looking at the Book of Job and stuff is very much in line with a lot of my interests, which are about like prayer as, on the one hand, a very metabolized utterance, you know, like you're one voice in many making this utterance together that has been sort of like worn smooth over the ages. But then also it's a highly sanctioned utterance. Like, for instance, a big concern for me is, well, especially in the thing I'm working on at the moment, actually, the Catholic Church. And the Catholic Church is actually a genius piece of informational infrastructure. You know, you have like a guy in every community who reports to his guy higher up the food chain, and it all goes back to Rome. And actually, it's this like supremely well-organized, you know, kind of like information distribution mechanism whereby the message gets decided centrally and then distributed. And the demographic group that is distributing that message is deliberately kept very small so as to limit the kind of opportunity for mutiny within. And also, you know, Camille kind of picking up on the Book of Job and, you know, bits from the Old Testament where at the end of the day, you know, we think of the Bible as this, I mean, it is the sanctioned version of lots of different stories, and it has been used to many ends. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's kind of like a baggy, messy anthology with a lot of funky shit going on. I hope we're allowed to swear.
Yeah.
And so, drawing attention to that fact, and then also drawing attention to, I mean, one of my huge things that I'm still so interested in is the Gnostic Gospels, which are basically, you know, like, I guess if you were to be cynical, you'd call them Bible fan fiction. But if you were to be very much on the side of the Gnostic Gospels, which I am, you would say that they are like alternative versions of Bible stories or continuations of certain stories in the Bible that didn't get the kind of centralized approval to go into the finished version. And so they have been cast out, I mean, without wanting to rely too heavily on biblical metaphor, you know, into the wilderness. I mean, that's the other thing. You find yourself just like so suffocated by biblical metaphor, I think, in the tradition we're working with. And that's also like its own set of weeds to wade through. And I have reached the end of my rather rambly point.
Can I add something, though? Because there's something else that struck me that we have in common very much as an interest and that appears in, you know, probably all the poems we're going to read today. And that is an interest in etymology, in the history of words. In the bit that you read earlier, you read out your line, incendiary as a vernacular. And I know that in the written version, corpulent as a pearl or a corpulent pearl, you have that line break after corp, which emphasizes the root of that word in, you know, corpus or body. And I do a lot of that kind of thing as well, a lot of etymological play. And I think that comes from a couple of different desires, one of which is, you know, that we understand now that there is no ideal root of language. There is no universalism, and we are all going around constantly misunderstanding each other. But also we understand that societies, communities all around the world have contributed to these languages that are considered to be the dominant language in some way. And a lot of the work that people are doing in etymology now, because it's coming up a lot in contemporary poetry, is an attempt to recover histories that have been buried or that just should be better known, or to, you know, play with the words in a way that's not actually that playful.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that for me, playing, like highlighting, as you say, the buried histories within words and kind of like showing the vessels that they have been previously by like cutting them up or emphasizing them in certain ways is really important to me. And I mean, there are other languages in Amnion. You know, there's Latin, there's some ancient Coptic, that's the epigraph, there's Greek, you know, so all these, but I'm very interested in languages which have been used to create informational monopolies. So like Latin is a good one in the history of religion, and sort of like the ends it has been put to. But then also English as, you know, a piece of imperial infrastructure as well. The same goes for Spanish. You know, I mean, like there's a lot of stuff about my Filipino family in there where, you know, for them, that was the imperializing language.
I'm interested in this notion of burial, and but the buried meanings. Is it immediately, Camille, when you're talking about, yeah, in etymology, there's a quote, a nice quote by Simon Dentrith, which seems to kind of, which is quite provocative, which is that the dictionary is the graveyard of language, and most people sort of tend to take that as a kind of pejorative or diminishing kind of comment. But I think actually it's quite a cool analogy, because it's saying that these words are not that they are kind of graveyards. If you like graveyards, then it's a good it's a very positive analogy. The way that they kind of record history, that they tell you about, they're also you know, record power. And you look at you know, a pauper's grave, or a, you know, a huge family crypt, or you know, dynastic crypt. They sort of they're hugely revealing in terms of history. So yeah, I was interested. That seemed kind of yeah. You like graves as well. So etymologies are a kind of a portal into history in the same way that a graveyard could be. Is that?
Yeah, I suppose so. That idea of dictionary as graveyard, I think, insofar as a graveyard is also a garden, maybe because the dictionary is not. Not prescriptive. It's not setting things in stone and burying things necessarily. It's a descriptive thing, isn't it, really? It's a gathering of the usage that we have right now. And if it's a good dictionary, then it'll also include information about how a word has been used in the past. So
there are things growing from those roots all the time. And that's what's so fascinating about etymology, is that by following how a word has changed from, you know, that buried skeleton under the ground into the tree that now stands over it, you see a huge amount about the process of that and how it happened and, you know, what fertilized it or how it became the kind of tree that it now is. This has become quite a tortured metaphor, but
yes, it's good. I'm thinking about all the sort of the words that have rotted down and the nutrients dispersed into.
Well, I like the way you talked about prayer as metabolized utterance, which feels related to this.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, because this is definitely a concern of mine, because I mean, there's a bit in Amnion which is sort of about like the Sutton Hoo site, the ship burial in Suffolk. And when I first learned about Sutton Hoo, I didn't understand what they were talking about when they said they found a ship, but actually the ship couldn't be exhumed because it was gone. So I was like, what do you mean? How do we know there was a ship if it's gone? And basically, of course, you know, it's like compacted sand from the wood of the ship that, you know, can't really be disturbed too much, but is, you know, reveals the skeleton of what is basically a Viking longboat. And I was completely taken with that idea of you put the ship in the ground, but you don't dig too deeply into the ground because then you cover it over with a mound and then the mound becomes a sort of slightly like noteworthy part of the local landscape, but you don't really know what's inside. And so I love that idea, to go back to what Camille is saying about, you know, the skeleton that nourishes the tree. You know, it's like the landscape hints at what lies beneath. And of course, like with the English language, so much of it is obsolete. So like we scratch the surface of it every day. And I think I have quite a sort of environmentalist way of thinking about language, because I think that if you don't use it, it dies. And so a couple of the reviews of Amnion have picked up on like slightly esoteric words and phrases. And I know it's extremely poor form to sort of want to rebut your reviews, but I find that really interesting as a critique, because on the one hand, Google exists and we can use it. It's at the reach of your thumb. So, you know, there's that. And also, yeah, I think that there's so much pleasure in like finding a funky word. So like all the names of the parts of Amnion are just kind of words that I stumbled across in quite a sort of like foragey way. Like it was all happenstance that I found them. I mean, the title of the book, you know, came from flipping open a biology textbook when I was 15 and thinking, oh, that can be the name for the thing. So yeah, you know, it just sort of like running around and picking fun stuff up.
Yeah, I think of it as kind of like a curiosity project, like an author who I am obsessed with and talk about a lot on the podcast, Sylvia Legree, is also a kind of master of etymology and this idea of digging into words, I suppose, uncovering words, histories, playing with the histories of words, also with a kind of ecological or environmental focus, I suppose, in a slightly more direct way, because she often just writes about landscape. And interestingly, that criticism has been leveled at her for this use of a kind of heightened or elitist language. And it's my like hugest bugbear, because I find that critique often comes from largely middle-class spaces who think they're able to deign what is readable or not to an expanse of people. And actually, a poet like Sylvia Legree has no formal education and is fanatic about language and mines different kinds of publications, texts, you know, reaches back through like histories to uncover lost or forgotten words. She invents her own vocabulary, which we also talked about when we were working on Amnion, like the ways in which a word invented or mined or discovered could have associations built into it. And I really defend that usage of the esoteric language as a kind of I don't know, it's like it just creates such a texture within the text and a network and a map. It's a whole new way of mapping text. And I think about the kind of sense that you get from more traditional or whatever, I'm using quotes right now, poetic forms like rhyme, which build in a kind of meaning. And I think that, Camille, you're so right, this move towards etymology has a kind of political background to it, wherein people are trying to sort of create new archives or sort of bring in older or lost or being lost ways of speaking to each other and talking through poems.
Yeah, I think it has two prongs, really. Mm. And one of them is that political prong of trying to recover things that have been lost or give attention to things that deserve more than they've had, or even reject ideas that we have in the language and say that's no longer fit for purpose. But on the other hand, there is something that you've just said, which is that ecological aspect. I think there's a sort of desire that connects to the religious themes in our work, for instance, to recover an Edenic world, essentially, a world in which language is a very different, more flourishing kind of thing that we all shared together. And now through human error and all this chaos and everything, it's, the world is on fire and we've leveled everything and so on. And the poet that I thought of when you were talking about Sylvia Legree and how she uses words is Geoffrey Hill. And he very much had that that post-lapsarian project at the heart of his work, and thought that if only we could get back to a form of language that was comprehensible to everyone, then maybe things would be different.
Yeah, it's a total rebuttal to the idea that we need a simplistic rhetoric, which is, in my opinion, one of the reasons that we're in this Brexit.
I think there's something about the that objection to the esoteric in poetry or language, which comes from like this kind of sense that language should be, that anything too self-conscious is kind of like the artifice shows itself, and it's kind of. But I think that is probably classist as well, that objection, because it suggests that we should use the language that we know, and like it sort of spills out of us in this sensuous overflow with ourselves and our souls as the origin point, like sort of Plato Socratic notions. But like actually there's maybe a perceived like snobbery about people who have to find who have looked in language and found it. Like the idea that something might be deployed is somehow crasser. Mm. Is crasser a word? I've deployed it. I don't care. I think there's something that one should simply have a large vocabulary. And if one one looks for words outside of one's vocabulary and deploys them, well, that is the most
distasteful
and immodest sort of attempt at ascending out of one's class. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
that's what it seems to
it's
be.
It's totally that.
And well, for me as a young woman as well, like, I mean, I, like, there are Greek words that form the titles of, like, parts of Amnion and stuff, and yeah, bits of Latin. And so, you know, you're making a bid for this language which has had this, very paternalistic implementation, and that is very much by design. Like, at one point, I call it the language of the fathers in the book, and it is this sort of, like, state-building, authoritarian, utterance. And so to be, like, the young woman whose body is as incendiary as a vernacular, I mean, like, I think young women are told that in general. That's a general suggestion is very much the thing, and yet feels very like that is important work to be doing.
It really is. Camille, I wonder whether we could hear a bit more of your vocabulary and whether you'd like to read us maybe an excerpt
from either one of your...
Can I fangirl really quickly on, well, just like appreciation of Camille's work? I feel like they're... So we've talked about Sylvia Legree, and I think both of us are... It would be fair to say both of us are quite preoccupied with texture, textual texture. And it makes me think of sort of early medieval objects and the Anglo-Saxon tradition of the speaking object and this sort of like... incarnate metaphysical idea of like in a highly material culture, which is not the same thing as a highly materialistic culture, but where like objects have prestige because they are made by hand. I actually think that that's something I look to in my writing, perhaps more than writing that's in a book. Or, you know, so I just read Jacob Polley's book, which I love as well.
Material Properties.
Yeah, which is sort of all about like the Exeter book being a speaking piece of... Yeah, the word, the living word. anyway, sorry, go ahead.
That was lovely.
That was lovely, thank you.
Yeah, I actually was going to say
I'm
no.
I'm going to try and do the same.
I was going to do it anyway.
That really is an unbecoming, immodest act.
Fangirls forever.
No, we're all fangirls here.
No, I do think it's a very clever pairing that you've done, I think. You know, I've admired Stephanie's work for a while, and we've worked together on TLS stuff before, so it's great to be, you know, here talking about this stuff.
Shout out to Hannah Marshall, our producer.
Yeah.
Keeping it.
It's like first dates here, basically.
Yeah, Camille, go ahead.
Right. So I'll read one now from the sequence that is at the end of the volume, and this is called, it's called My Word. It's from the spiritual diary of Dr. John Dee. A Don, mathematician, navigator, and revered astrologer to Queen Elizabeth I, who between 1582 and 1608 travelled across the continent with his unruly scryer, Edward Kelly, and his family in search of the word, the divine knowledge or language that had long eluded him. So I'll just read one of the bits from near the end of that sequence. July 5th, 1596 to July 5th, 1600. Move I thank the Queen, to Lancashire, where once for coining cropped they Kelly's ears, for clipping gold from coins. In golden years he never stopped refreshing word and sign. Here mice and meat carts throng root rook in muscular dung. Here Carnifex's cuts are shocked with yellow fat. Yet your single fancy stays stuck in my throat. I dread the cleft feet of those fleshy and mincing herds. I cringe from the tang of retted flax, the accent with a firmer word for eggs, the dialect's steamed slaw. Word, save me from this filthy creep of noise. Word, save me from the human voice and its red exhalations, wutherings of muck, bone smoke, and cumbered tumbril, tomb shelved like a bookcase. Kelly lived here, learnt it here. In world, more is encrypted. Must have sounded out this doghole and then sought me with my studied burning ambushes of stars. He whimpered over witches in mild, clotted northern dark. He'd known unholy masses and the college where I now work to my shame. He brought to me the seed of you, seemed sent. Although I have my métier today in libraries and learning, no more bell nor book nor candle nor divine diktat, inoculate against all further hope of fame by my low infamy, my words still mither I and chase selflessly after you, although I know you know I cannot spell. But as the weakening of hearing quickens smell, as body withers, thickens still my soul, else set me free. Might yet, as I sit drunk and pervious beneath the wheeling suns, and tell me I am not maladjusted, aimless, malapropped as mickle mustard seed, digesting mute inside gut's chest now to be furious at these thens, nows, agains, at history's heaped sty, its cullet's immutable ice, its oars' black snore. Word, save me from the simmering heap of noise. Word, save me from this broken voice. I smell its brokenness. Oh, who stand privy to mine losses, calcified like calculus's little stones in words? There is a singed ring on my desk. The college fellow's joke is from the devil's hoof. But I know better, don't I?
Thank you. I hope that I am one day described as an unruly scryer. That's my aim. Stephanie.
So I am going to read a passage of the book that I've actually never read aloud before. And I think, yeah, just really quickly, I think, Camille, our ways of thinking about these things tessellate in so many ways, but actually my way of thinking about language is not to be getting back to something Edenic, but more to kind of call out the kitschiness, call out the kitsch everywhere and celebrate it. But I think there's something about that kind of technicolor vision of full and proper communication, mm-hmm. which, delights and amuses me. But I don't think it can be attained. So this is, again, from the same part of Amnion, which is at a cathedral school in England. Life-size statues of naked men with our sightlines going up his loincloth. Surplices smoothing over tits. We were made to carry hymn books in blue and gold, which had some variation on Jesus is hot, fuck, in four-way biro, green. They were confirmed so as to be gifted hoops and cufflinks of white gold, common prayers. They wanted to marry in squat flint churches, as if they were tourists, with big white dresses, as if they were cakes. Once a month came round the metallic, zinkish smell in the corridors of all our blood clumping in bins. Another thing which completely fascinated me about being at an English boarding school was a thing that I am going to just call institutional homoeroticism, which... Yeah, I would love to see lots of writing about that because I find it completely fascinating. And so on that note, on Monday nights, we changed our bedding. In the boys' houses, this was done for them. The new headmaster instated that girls were not allowed into the dining hall unless their legs were covered. A church education will teach you that the monopoly of interpretation is just.
Thank you so much, both. This has been an amazing conversation. And it's just been a delight to have you both here. Thank you so much.
It's been really interesting. And it's nice to sort of see... sometimes you have people who are kind of like... whose contrasting views sort of create nice energy. But a little bit of simpatico... and also highlights like distinctions and different characters, but also, yeah, I think it's been really fun to hear that conversation.
Yeah, really, really generative.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Yeah, thank you.
Hi, I'm Kay Patrick, and this is a poem I wrote called Splash. The pair of them arrive to spot the beavers in the twitch before morning. Breakfast in a brown paper bag, quick conspiracy of fruit. Under one cherry is another rotting cherry. Some beaver dams are over 100 metres long or deep. Always nice to see a bodies getting to work. Nodding not in time, they stand, two people, on the flattest rock. Shared weather between them, a milk breeze. Isn't it good to be obsessed with animals? Earlier, instead of sex, they had a competitive discussion. The scent sack of a beaver has this alarmingly romantic smell. Leather, vanilla, used in perfumes and once almost cigarettes. A moon, too, is named after a beaver, after beavers, after more ancient beavers. The beaver fur is very warm. Beaver teeth marks on the trees are cute, but the teeth themselves are not. Technically, a beaver is a rodent. Each person on the flat rock tries not to move and judges the other person for their movements. Inspired by the outdoors, they both need to shit. They are afraid to eat the cherries. The beavers might be put off by other animals' teeth. The cherry stones stay mouth-warm in their palms. Horsefly bites start to feel personal, behind the knees especially. Every sound is removed from its centre. Grass frightening their shins is also removed from its centre. Darkness is so well maintained, daytime by comparison is ramshackle. Eyes turn inside out. Ears perk in the wrong direction. Water, tiny waters, maybe a fish, its pout breaking the surface, rising up from the interior to kiss the exterior. The pair of them blink through the fossils left by sleep and wait.
Love that poem so much by Kay Patrick.
Yeah. Some really, like, I love the way that in the poem the speaker is sort of third person-y, right?
Mm.
It's just happening, but the speaker, they come through.
Mm. Mm.
They're kind of arriving gradually through these little details, and I love that as a sort of like creep that this the intelligence of the poem itself, because it's not named, it's not an I. That I love the way that intelligent life emerges through the details.
I feel like Kay has this like flurry of phrase. That's the way I think about it. Like this quick conspiracy of fruit, horsefly bites starting to feel personal.
Gorgeous.
Grass frightening the shins. And I think this like phrase focus, this accumulation of like weird phrase that if you kind of separate it out, you can see how it like accumulates into this larger kind of, exactly what you were saying, this sort of like landscape and story and narrative.
Well, they also have, they used like, you mentioned frightening their shins, the grass, and like the verbs are great. Like there's that, there's the twitch. I mean, that's obviously being deployed as a noun there, I think, in the twitch before morning. But there was also another one. What was that? The perk of something? Ears perk in the wrong direction. I mean, that's just like, often when you get like busy verbs, the voice can seem kind of overdressed or a little bit baroque, but there's something so careful and so like honed in on the image. And of course, because the poem's a little bit third person-y, it's, you don't have that thing of like, oh, somebody's showing off with their busy language. It's just this very exacting, descriptive attentiveness.
There's a plainness in the kind of statement making as well, which makes the phrases sing all the more. And something that I love about this poem and other of Kay Patrick's poem is the way that nature or whatever, like in scare quotes, is situated, and the kind of merging of a distanced human with a strange humanized nature, the moon after the beaver sack in the perfume, in the nearly cigarettes. There's such a kind of easy way of acknowledging the intertwining, the contemporary weird intertwining of animal and human. And they even say, isn't it good to be obsessed with animals? And like, this poem is such a weird takedown of like, or not takedown, it's just like a really, really amazing alternative way to approach the idea of the animal as symbol in poem.
An antidote.
Yeah.
Under one cherry is another rotting cherry. I don't know, there's something a little bit Dutch mastery about this kind of the way in which Kay is drawing here. Like the maybe that's it, like the human observation of nature is like in a kind of arrangement. It turns like what's happening into a slightly still life thing.
And what's weird is it encroaches.
Moving still life, sorry.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally.
A moving life.
Like the horsefly bites start to feel personal. The grass is frightening the shins. It's like this kind of like this lush green canopied scene is like pressing down.
Yeah.
Like the ecology of it is kind of like encroaching on the humanness almost. It feels very like you're being suffocated by green.
I can imagine the idea forming over perhaps, I don't know, a gin and tonic before the yard arm. Let's get high and go and look at the beaver dam. And then you get there and you're bad high. You know, the beavers, everything's just a bit, oh no, there's a rotten cherry and everything's starting to like fascinate you, but also
the
gross.
The fruit's conspiring.
Yeah, it's grossing you out.
Yeah, it's quite a paranoid poem. Like darkness is well maintained. Daytime is ramshackle. It's like
a beaver is a rodent.
It's a kind of ecology it's a kind of like immersed in ecology that's like almost craving the cleanness of like being outside of that space, which I get actually when I'm like in nature or like I'm in the wild landscape. I'm always like, I'm kind of scared. Like I love it, but I'm like, I'm scared and I kind of a bit want to go home.
Yeah.
And then when I'm in a city, I'm like, I want to be out in nature. It really wrestles with that tension of like, where are you supposed to be?
Yeah. Or like when I think of like how like, the bottom of a slug, like is actually like thousands of tiny teeth, and that is just like, but like also like, and I love a snail, but like sometimes you can like if you've got a snail crawling around your hand, you can suddenly be like shocked, by its like little its intelligence, or it might be having a little taste of of your salty surface, and you're just like, ah, no, you know, actually get this off me. I remember when I was a kid. I had stick insects, and I'd love getting the stick insects out and watching them crawl. And then suddenly there would be this moment where I was just like,
I have an insect on.
Yeah, because they were quite large.
Yeah, they would get big, and some of them flew. You could buy rare ones that like flew around.
Ours weren't flying, but they did have late eggs.
Oh yeah, and you can just hatch the eggs.
We put them in wet cotton wool and it had to be in a warm place. You had like an airing cupboard. We put them in an ice cream tub in cotton wool in the airing cupboard.
Did they ever escape?
No. The ice cream tub fell down the back of the airing cupboard.
Oh my God.
And all the eggs. So my mum was just terrified that she'd one day just discover like...
They're probably living in the walls.
There could be a host. My brother did take a photo of a stick insect in the wild in Norfolk like a couple of years ago. Could be
probably. I mean,
the offspring of my escaped brood. But I feel like this poem is kind of that reaches into that kind of is like when the ice cream tub of eggs falls down the back.
Yeah, it's like when the nature has encroached a little bit too much in ways that we didn't expect or want. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awesome.
Love it.
And now we have an audio postcard from Hannah Sullivan's Was It For This?
A refrain from Was It For This? I wanted all of it again to do again. A grown-up spoon, a thumbnail puncturing a daisy stem, spare floppy disks, that silver paper from fresh cigarettes and a blue-grey flimsy night in June, a lid that won't quite fit the day, the boxwood yellowing in strips. So, last summer, next, a profligate excess of summertime to come and walking home, tip of dawn as a yellow awning is pulled down and the future is as cleft and fuzzily unripe as peaches swung inside a paper prism. Saved up to look forward to, but also capable of blandness. A future sensitive to error.
That was the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Rachel Allen and Jack Underwood and produced by Hannah Marshall, Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen for Faber and Faber.
You can listen to our podcast on your favourite audio platform. And don't forget to subscribe, rate and tell your friends about our show.